Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Pandemic Journal, a satiric but somewhat optimistic view of a pandemic and a community now in a very complicated relationship, plus a song or two and a short poem from 1935. I hope you'll stay tuned. From time to time, I'm going to record some observations about the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, and especially how my fellow citizens are responding to the pandemic. This is not late-breaking news, but rather reflections from an observant but somewhat jaundiced eye. Plus a bit of chronology of how the disease unfolded in Connecticut. These observations will be wide-ranging and idiosyncratic. For instance, the first topic I explore in any depth is, of course, Daniel Defoe. Let's call this segment of the show Pandemic Journal. Long-time listeners of our home station, WWUH-FM in West Hartford, will catch the echo. The late George Michael Ivica's fine weekly program was Assassination Journal, on the Kennedy assassination and cover-up. Then Keith Brown, host of the station's long-running program Gay Spirit, launched a regular segment of his show called Epidemic Journal, on the AIDS crisis. I first thought of using the title Epidemic Journal here. The phrase has a great rhythm to it. Epidemic Journal. My fellow English majors are all thinking trochaic trimeter. You betcha. But then I remembered Keith Brown and decided that he had first dibs. So we'll settle for Pandemic Journal. I'm also thinking of Daniel Defoe's fine work of fiction, Journal of the Plague Year. That was published in 1722. You know Defoe as the author of The Adventures of Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe had some very good parts, but it's a tough slog overall, with too many pages of sheer tedium. Schools like Robinson Crusoe because it celebrates all the ruling class white imperialist virtues. And it also celebrates the plucky little guy who embodies all those virtues. Schools also like Robinson Crusoe because it does not have any sex in it. In mine humble opinion, Defoe's great work is not Robinson Crusoe, not even Moll Flanders, but rather Journal of the Plague Year. That doesn't have any sex either, but it's a great read, despite this glaring omission. London was hit by the bubonic plague in the spring of 1665. The plague lingered in London for almost a year. Then the city burned down, but that's another story. Anyway, during the year of the plague, Defoe was 5 years old, and surely did not venture far from home. He wrote Journal of the Plague Year 56 years later. It is a pseudo-memoir. It pretends to be a day-by-day account compiled by a London resident in 1665-66. It is extremely realistic, extremely plausible, a superb work of historical fiction. You could never tell that it is fiction, not a genuine contemporary record. Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe. Ask for it at your local Barnes & Noble. They'll probably say, never heard of it, and try to sell you one of the 17 versions of Robinson Crusoe that they stock. But your public library should have it when it opens up again. Full disclosure, my pandemic journal is not as good as Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year. Even I know that. Let us begin anyway. Episode 1 of Pandemic Journal on New World Notes. Fanfare, please. Dateline, Central Connecticut, St. Patrick's Day, 2020. I am recording these observations on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. St. Patrick's Day started off with the traditional annual surprise snowfall. This happens remarkably often in the Hartford area. 3 or 4 weeks of rising temperatures, flower buds appearing, people's spring allergies kicking in. Then, on St. Patrick's Day, God sends a snowstorm to dampen the self-glorifying parade of the transplanted Hibernians. Do the green-clad paraders ever take the hint? Do they ever recall that the greatest of the seven deadly sins is pride? Certainly not. Then the next year, the same thing happens all over again. This year, God sent just a few flurries as a gentle reminder. The snow had all vanished by 7 a.m. Perhaps this year's heavenly rebuke to the Irish was so gentle because by this time it was a moot point. The civil authorities had already canceled all parades. Then the authorities added insult to injury, or vice versa, by also closing all the taverns. The global pandemic is now decimating Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. As just one example, Italy is now in a major lockdown. As of mid-March, Italy had about 25,000 cases and has had more than 1,800 deaths. Here in Northeast United States, the state governments of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut have taken the lead. In all three states, restaurants, taverns, gymnasiums, and movie theaters have been closed until further notice. Have a safe and sane St. Patrick's Day, lads. Schools were closed a few days earlier. In Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York, the three governors are in cahoots, and rightly so. Everyone is remarking on the total absence of any coherent guidance, let alone help, from Washington, D.C. As recently as a week before, President Trump was calling the coronavirus fake news, and he was telling people to, quote, relax, unquote. Coronavirus test kits would normally be rushed into production by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and rapidly distributed in the field. But the test kits are still in remarkably short supply. Even the corporate-controlled media have been pointing out that, in South Korea, for one, the government's response to the crisis was orders of magnitude better than in the United States. By the way, a month ago, the corporate-controlled media were constantly bashing China for not responding quickly enough to the totally unexpected virus outbreak in Wuhan. By contrast, the virus's arrival in the U.S. was totally predictable and expected. Compared with the U.S. response to the crisis, the Chinese response is now looking very good. So the media have decided to pause their China bashing for the moment. According to news reports, so bad is the confusion in the White House West Wing that Jared Kushner, uninvited, decided to anoint himself de facto coronavirus czar and impose some order on the executive chaos. Can you even imagine a situation that is so screwed up that injecting Jared Kushner into the mix would improve things? I mean, this is the man who created the latest Middle East peace solution without bothering to talk to a single Palestinian. In any case, Kushner is reported to be the principal author of President Trump's disastrous March 11 address to the nation on the pandemic. Reviews of the address varied slightly. Trump's liberal critics judged the address indefensible. On the other hand, Trump's staunchest Republican supporters in Congress called it only disappointing. Anyway, given the failure of the Trump administration to say or do anything useful, or even coherent, it fell to the state governors and local officials and ourselves alone to address this international and national crisis. Yes, ourselves alone. That's Sinn Féin in Gaelic. And speaking of the Irish, as of St. Patrick's Day 2020, the pandemic has not yet hit Connecticut hard. Let's go back a week. On March 10, Connecticut had 2 confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus infection, or of COVID-19, to save 7 syllables. On March 10, Governor Lamont declared a state of emergency in Connecticut. On March 12 and 13, many colleges and public schools announced imminent closings. The governor waived the state requirement of at least 180 days of instructions in the public school year. Confirmed and presumptive cases grew from 2 to 5 in Connecticut. Presumptive because precious few test kits were to be had. By this point, professional and college basketball authorities had canceled the remaining games of the season. Sunday, March 13, now 26 cases reported in Connecticut. By Monday, March 16, the governor had banned public gatherings of more than 250 people. 250? In a pandemic? Well, no politician was ready to destroy the wedding reception industry or face the wrath of thousands of angry middle-class women for destroying the most important event of their entire lives, which is the $100,000 reception that follows the wedding to her first husband. March 16, 8 p.m., no more attending restaurants, taverns, gyms, or movie theaters. Restaurant takeout is still permitted. In fact, the governor urged citizens to help keep local businesses alive by ordering food for takeout or delivery, and by buying restaurant gift certificates for future use. According to the statewide Restaurant Trade Association, Connecticut has 8,500 dining and/or drinking establishments. Together, they employ 160,000 people. I will add that most of these people receive very low wages and few or no benefits. They will suffer in this crisis, and no amount of takeout is going to keep them all employed. That brings us up to now, St. Patrick's Day, Tuesday, March 17. Now, gatherings of more than 50 people are prohibited, including church services. Connecticut COVID-19 cases have risen from 26 to 41. So, in 1 week, 2 to 5 to 26 to 41. Plot that curve on a graph and extrapolate the data into the next couple of weeks. Oh my! As Warren Zevon sang, it ain't that pretty at all. The public library suddenly has closed. And Connecticut's 2 large Indian-owned casinos will close tonight. These are on tribal land, and the governor does not have the authority to shut them down. but the governor's office had a tete-a-tete with leaders of the Mohegans and the Mashantucket Pequots, and an agreement was soon reached. So, no more casino gambling. Looks like we're going to have a safe and sane St. Patrick's Day, whether we want one or not. At times like these, what will keep us together, and alive and well, if anything, is the mutual support of ourselves, of our neighbors, our families, our immediate community. No fireside chats from the likes of Mr. Trump reassuring us that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Instead, we will help each other get through this. David Rovix has a brand new song on the very subject, just recorded live, March 4, 2020, in Brisbane, Australia. The song goes like this.
There's foreboding in the air, waiting for an earthquake. Pandemic spreading, no telling how it might remake a world so divided in so many, many ways. Anyone can see it's no way to greet such days when you can shut your borders, but it'll barely slow the spread with a million people homeless and not enough hospital beds. In times like these, we find out that a society is only just as strong as our solidarity. The foreboding in the air can get only thicker as we see our leaders passing blame and getting sicker. A crashing economy, leaders fraught with indecision, only capable of thinking like bought-off politicians. Not enough testing kits, and the one you got were broken. But hey, the president has spoken. In times like these, we find out that a society is only just as strong as our solidarity. A million people wake up in the morning thinking thoughts they never had till they found that they were sinking on a cruise ship full of holes where if you can't catch the breeze, there are no fences tall enough to keep out the disease. Lifting every boat or watching them all sink, ready or not, we're standing on the brink. In times like these, we find out that a society is only just as strong as our solidarity. Contain an epidemic like in Wuhan or in Seoul, or watch a catastrophe take its toll. Hide behind our gates, cowering afraid, or organize our neighbors in mutual aid. In synchronicity, such great things can be done. A planet to lose, or a world to be won. In times like these, we find out that a society is only just as strong as our solidarity. In times like these, we find out that a society is only just as strong as our solidarity.
Thank you all very much.
I was also planning to talk about this, the second great national toilet paper shortage of my lifetime. The first was in 1973. I'll save that for the next installment of Pandemic Journal. Let's bring this one to a close. On St. Patrick's Day for Pandemic Journal, this has been Kenneth Doust. Let's go out with one or maybe two spoken compositions that speak to our times. Here is a short poem called The Yachts. It was written by the American poet William Carlos Williams in 1935. In this vintage recording, it is read by Williams himself, I believe. Why does our country have such a horrible health care system? Why does your doctor, if you are fortunate enough to have a doctor, why does the doctor have no coronavirus test kits? Part of the answer is that capitalism is dedicated to transferring all the wealth of the nation away from the workers up to the small minority of already wealthy people at the very top, the major stockholders. Since that is what the actual rulers want, that is what both political parties strive to give them. Yes, the Republicans are even more blatant about it than the Democrats are, but the Democrats too have been pursuing these same policies for the last 75 years or more. Consider how Obama reneged on his campaign promises and saddled us with nothing more than that lamentable Obamacare program, which was originally designed by a right-wing think tank and first instituted in one state by its conservative Republican governor, Mitt Romney of Massachusetts. Obama bought the plan. The Yachts nominally describes a sailboat race, but soon we figure out that the racing yachts are symbols. They represent the rich elite. And by the end of the poem, the yachts are destroying and drowning the working stiffs who have been tossed overboard. Here is The Yachts.
The Yachts. The yachts contend in a sea which the land partly encloses, shielding them from the two heavy blows of an ungoverned ocean, which, when it chooses, tortures the biggest hulls the best man knows to pit against its beatings and sinks them pitilessly. Moth-like in mists, scintillant in the minute brilliance of cloudless days, with broad-bellying sails, they glide to the wind, tossing green water from their sharp prows, while over them the crew crawls ant-like, solicitously grooming them, releasing, making fast, as they turn, lean far over, and having caught the wind again, side by side, head for the mark. In a well-guarded arena of open water, surrounded by lesser and greater craft, which, sycophant, lumbering and flittering follow them, they appear youthful, rare as the light of a happy eye, live with the grace of all that in the mind is feckless, free, and naturally to be desired. Now the sea which holds them is moody, lapping their glossy sides as if feeling for some slightest flaw, but fails completely. Today no race. Then the wind comes again. The yachts move, jockeying for a start. The signal is set, and they are off. Now the waves strike at them, but they are too well made. They slip through, though they take in canvas. Arms with hands grasping seek to clutch at the prows. Bodies thrown recklessly in the way are cut aside. It is a sea of faces about them in agony, in despair, until the horror of the race dawns staggering the mind. The whole sea become an entanglement of watery bodies, lost to the world, bearing what they cannot hold, broken, beaten, desolate, reaching from the dead to be taken up. They cry out, failing, failing, their cries rising in waves still as the skillful yachts pass over.
William Carlos Williams, reading his fine poem on class warfare, The Yachts. He wrote that poem in 1935, and he made that recording in 1945. Preceding that was a bit of Democratic Party bashing by yours truly. And I will bash further real soon now, when the party bigwigs and major donors finally succeed in ousting Bernie Sanders and replacing him with, yet again, a candidate nobody wants. Yes, that would be Mr. Biden. Yes, it's 2016 all over again. But don't take my word for it. Here's a recent epistle from Jim Hightower.
We might expect that corporate billionaires and Koch-funded Republican right-wingers would be howl-at-the-moon opponents of a wealth tax, Medicare for all, and other big progressive ideas to help improve the circumstances of America's workaday majority. But Democrats? Unfortunately, yes. Not grassroots Dems, but a gaggle of don't-rock-the-corporate-boat fraidy cat Democrats. These naysayers are the party's old line pals, lobbyists, and other insider elites who are now screeching that Democratic candidates must back off those big proposals. Why? Because, they squawk, being so bold, so progressive, so, well, so Democratic will scare voters. As one meekly put it, when you say Medicare for all, it's a risk. It makes people afraid. Excuse me, but in my speeches and writings, I say Medicare for all a lot. And far from cowering, people stand up and cheer. In fact, the New York Times has just reported that 81% of Democrats and 2/3 of independents support Medicare for all. Even apple pie doesn't score that high. It's simply a lie that the people are afraid of the idea of everyone getting public-financed health care. So who really fears it? Three special interest groups, insurance company profiteers, big pharma price gougers, and the political insiders who are hooked on funding from these corporations. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only is it a pusillanimous fabrication to claim that the people oppose any changes stronger than corporate minimalism, it's also political folly. If the Democratic Party won't stand up for the transformative structural changes that America's middle and low-income majority clearly wants and needs, why would those people stand up for Democrats? As the 2016 presidential election taught us, a whole lot of the working-class Democrats the party counts on won't.
And that about wraps up this edition of New World Notes. David Rovick's song was titled Viral Solidarity. You can find a copy on YouTube. Another installment of Pandemic Journal will find its way to your eardrums sometime in the future. Don't let me forget to talk about the great toilet paper shortage of 1973. Find a free archive of our program on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Stay healthy, wash your hands, and don't flush those hand sanitizer tissues. They clog the pipes. See you.